Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. You're going to love her. Her name is Rachel Barwell, and she's a dyslexia educator and an advocate for women's empowerment and improving food security. And wait till you hear what she's doing. Not only does she have a full-time job, but she is an advocate for some very special people in Africa. So welcome, Rachel. Hello.
Thank you for that warm welcome.
You're welcome. And I forgot to say, she lives in New Zealand. That's why she sounds so adorable.
Yeah, I'm the one with the accent. That's right.
Yes, you are. I don't have an accent. So anyway, yeah, but it's so cute. Okay, so I don't know if you think it's cute, but I think it's cute. Okay, so Rachel's background, I'll just say a little bit. She was born and raised in New Zealand, lived on an agricultural aid project, UNDP, in southwestern Tanzania in East Africa, age 7 to 11 in the 70s. That set the stage for what we're going to be hearing about today. And anything else you want to say about growing up? You know, you mentioned something about dyslexia or...
Yeah. How do you say? Go ahead. So a couple of things. You know, how we got to be in Tanzania is my father was... agricultural aid advisor to a project, very remote part of Tanzania. And it was such a contrast to my life here in rural New Zealand and such an eye-opener because we'd never traveled as a family before from this little Pacific island all the way to Africa via India and Pakistan. And so it was a huge cultural shift. And the thing that I remember most, well, there's a few key lessons from that time, but the biggest thing was how beautiful and happy the people were with so little. And that has stayed with me through my life. I look at the challenges we often face with our own abundance and life and everything like that. And then I look at what people manage with particularly on the continent, but other developing countries, and yet bring joy and happiness to their everyday experience. So that was a big lesson as a really young person, that you can be joyous regardless of perhaps what you have or don't have or your circumstances.
So, okay. And then can I ask you a couple questions? Yeah. When you say rural, you were from a rural area, which to me sounds like farming?
Yes. Yeah, so in New Zealand, I grew up on a sheep farm, a sheep and cropping farm. And then in the South Island of this country. And then when we were in Tanzania, it was a similar topography. New Zealand has lots of what they call high country, so tussock country up in the hills and things. And my father had experience in that area. And so it translated quite well to where we were in rural Tanzania, which was we're down the southwestern part near the Zambian and Malawi borders on the Livingstone Plateau, which apparently was discovered, so to speak, by Livingstone when he toured Africa back the previous century. But we were 10,000 feet above sea level and very similar landscape and similar soils and topography and tussock growing everywhere. And my father was all about helping at a local level, help people improve their pastures for their stock so that their stock would eat better food and, you know, thrive, really, was what it was all about.
So, but if you had a farm,
Did your dad run the farm or other people ran it? I mean, did he also have another job besides farming?
In New Zealand or in Tanzania?
Well, how did he go from, like, let's say he's a farmer in
Yeah,
New
so
Zealand. Well, how did he
he
all of a
was a
sudden
farmer.
end up in Tanzania, right?
Yeah,
Like,
so he was a farmer. He was a very good farmer and had a good reputation. He also was a farm consultant, and he'd built up a clientele through that. And the then New Zealand Ministry of Foreign Affairs got wind of him and said, "Would you be interested in this assignment in Tanzania?" So that's how we went from small town, rural New Zealand to very remote Tanzania, yeah, in the 17s. So yeah,
and
it was
you
one
were
of
there
those
for
things.
four, you were there for 4 years, right?
Yeah, nearly 4 years, 3.5 years. Yeah,
So who ran your farm when you were gone? Did you have
we
people?
he hired in a farm manager to look after it while
Wow.
we were away.
That's such an adventure. Was that the
Yes.
only time you left your home to do that, or did you go to other places as well?
No, we didn't. That was the one assignment we that he had that we went with as a family. I've traveled since, and he traveled a lot in his retirement. But it kind of opened our minds. New Zealand back then, it was quite difficult and expensive to travel around the world, and so we also had that opportunity whilst we were there as a family to see other parts of East Africa and got up into Kenya and things like that. And yeah, so it's a really mind-opening experience, and I think that has stayed with me now. And so I maintain quite an interest in other parts of the world and have always stayed interested in what happens in Africa. And I can't go to a bookstore without buying a book about some aspect of Africa. And that's just been in my blood
Oh.
since then. So yeah, that's a bit of a warning to people, really get interested in a place and it never leaves you, never leaves your heart.
So, okay. So, all right. So, back to you. So, you go back home and you, let's see, I'm reading through.
Carry on with life in rural New Zealand. And I think we were talking about this before. I was in a rural school, and sport was the big thing. If you were good at sport, then you did well. And if you were academic, there was really not that much interest in that. And I was really good at academics, and I really sucked at sport, to use a phrase. I couldn't catch. I'm 5'10", by the way, and ideal as a netball player, as a basketball player, and I could not catch anything to save myself. I was teased. I was called Butterfinger Barwells every time I dropped the ball. And in the end, I gave up on sport and learnt the piano and had some lessons to learn to swim to be able to save my life if needed, and found a lot of solace in that, and some success. But I missed all the sort of team bonding, team building kind of experiences that you get with team sports. And it really wasn't until in my 50s when I did some particular training that I started to understand why I couldn't catch a ball, and why a lot of my life was pretty uncoordinated. And I discovered at 50 that I had a form of neurodiversity called dyspraxia, which is the clumsy version of what we often know as dyslexia. So it's known also as developmental coordination delay. And some people have it in the extreme, like they have, as children, have difficulty learning to crawl and walk and use a knife and a fork and things like that. Mine wasn't extreme, but it was enough to be at least annoying. And certainly, I've had a lot of minor accidents in my life that were probably as a result of my lack of coordination. And so, and we'll get into a little bit what I do, but I love working now with young people with that challenge, so that they can start including themselves in activities and sport at school and have a full life, you know.
So is it part of the brain that causes that?
Yeah. So with
Like, how can you?
neurodiversity, yeah, with neurodiversity, we have different brain patternings, and we're not really sure what causes them. And you could spend many years, there's lots of research and debate about it. But the reality is, people think in different ways. And if you think with a more neurodiverse brain, you often think in pictures or sensations rather than in words or, thoughts in that way. And so when you have that kind of brain pattern, different things can disrupt it. So for me, my perception of things coming at me was not clear, was not accurate. So I couldn't clock, I guess, the speed of the ball or the angle of the ball. Or so I was always like this, and the ball would go past me or hit me in the face, or, you know, I just was uncoordinated, was how you would describe it. But the brain was not registering. So the depth of field was not clear. And with the training that I've done now, I've learned how to adjust that. And that's what I do with my clients now, whether it's with dyspraxia or with what I'm kind of more known for is the dyslexia. It's learning to control those things that trigger the misperceptions. So with dyslexia, it's a misperception or a false perception of the letters, which are the raw ingredients of words, and then misunderstanding or misperception of words, which are the base of reading and writing and spelling. So that's how that kind of comes about.
If a boy, let's say he's trying to catch it, and he, how do you fix that? I mean, is that something easy to say or no?
Yes and no. So what we deal with is the root cause of what triggers that misperception. So I work with a particular method called the Davis method, and the fundamental principle of that is we disorientate when something triggers us. So if I go back to the dyspraxia example, like catching a ball, I'm already in a likely to be triggered experience called pressure to catch something. And then I would disorientate and not accurately perceive with my brain things coming at me. And so I would mistime my catches or, you know, just completely miss them. So with reading, it's slightly different. It's that the picture thinking brain or the visual brain is trying to interpret a 2D image, which is text, with a 3D thinking brain. And so they end up with muddled up things. So often parents say their children get muddled up between the P's and the Q's, or the B's and the D's. Or I've had students say, oh, the N looks like a Z if you turn it sideways. And I go, yep, in your brain, it absolutely can do that. But on paper, it doesn't. And so we're learning to control the brain's tendency when triggered to muddle those letters up and straighten them out. So we work with a lot of work with plastilina clay, modeling the letters until the person has a clear perception or a clear view of each letter of each alphabet. And then they can construct the words, the basic words that make up our language. And when they construct words, we're kind of connecting a few things in that process. So we're connecting the shape of the words with, and the letters, the order of those letters, with also the meaning of that word. So if we don't have a meaning clear of a word, then it's going to cause us difficulty. We might misremember it, mispronounce it, or just skip over it. So our beautiful language, our English language, has 220 non-picture words. So if you think about a cat, you'll probably get a picture of a cat in your mind.
Right.
But if I said to you, can you think of a picture that is aligned with the word that, you probably wouldn't get a picture. No. And those words make up 60% of our language. Of our everyday language, just our everyday language, not the complex stuff, just our everyday language. And so if you've got a child who has dyslexia, reading dyslexia or writing dyslexia, and they're trying to interpret what's up on the board or what's in front of them, and 60% of it is triggering false interpretations or false perceptions, they're in a really confused state. And so they're really clever. I would say most neurodiverse people are well above average in intelligence. And so often you'll listen, and instead of saying the word, there might be a word home on the page, reading a sentence about home, and they get to that word and they can't find the right word, so they'll use the word house, which is close. It's a close approximation, but it's actually not the right word. And so what we want to do is have words like home and the, and we and she and he, all of those words mastered in their visual brain so that when they read them, they're getting the accurate pronunciation, the accurate spelling, and the accurate meaning, and they're not tripping over those words. And then their reading just magically becomes so much better. And it's, some people get disturbed when I say magically. I don't mean magic wand. I mean Monday can't read that sentence, Friday can read a whole paragraph. That's that kind of transformational improvement that we see with clients. Yeah.
And that's, would it be correct to say that those 260 words that make up, I don't know, did you say 60% or 80%?
Yeah. 220. Yeah, 220 make up about 60% of our everyday.
So tell me if I am too simplifying this. So by learning the 220, it probably helps them about 60% of it, at least, unmuddle. Is that true?
Yeah.
Or
yeah. Wow. And then, wow. So this is the crazy thing. Like often a kid can spell a much longer and seemingly complex word, but it relates to a picture, right? So we have a little bit of an in-joke in our community. You know, why can Billy spell the word Tyrannosaurus but not the word if?
Yeah.
Tyrannosaurus automatically brings a picture to mind. And so, boom. And picture thinkers think really quickly, right? They're much faster thinkers than the sedentary word thinkers. And but if is a non-picture word. There's no natural picture for it. So Billy would then go and make a model showing the meaning of if, which when you get into the dictionary definition is often quite complex. Most of us do not know the real meaning of words because we don't deep dive into the dictionary. And my happiest days are when students come to me and go, can we do some more dictionary exercises? I love it so much. And these are kids who have been like, I don't read, I hate writing, spelling sucks. And they've troop up with their dictionary going, can we play that dictionary game again? Because they're really into it. They love the meaning of the words because that's what brings the pictures to mind. And then when they're reading, they are generating movies in their head like crazy. So I often have a young client and I'll say, what's reading like? And they go, really? Like they do not like it. Yeah. And by the end of it, he goes, I've got videos in my head from what I just read. This is so cool. This is better than sci-fi. So
that is so cool. You know, one of my relatives, she had something and they taught her to take notes in pictures. So I guess that's why.
Well, that is. And then that's bridging. We're really wanting to bridge the gap between people's natural picture thinking tendencies, which is about 20% of the population think some more so in pictures and feelings or sensations than in words. And our education system, for whatever reason, got designed with word thinkers and auditory learners in mind. And maybe because a lot of teachers are built that way or their brains work that way. But you've still got, you know, you're 1 in 5 students, and that's probably on the increase, but that's the research that we've seen is 1 in 5 students are going to thrive more with picture-based and kinesthetic or hands-on learning and be able to match and then exceed their peers in their reading and writing capacities and time. So it's not that we're kind of doing something alternative to keep them busy. We're actually empowering them to start to catch up and then go ahead. And so there's some extraordinary dyslexics in the world who are authors who, you know, who work with words. They've overcome whatever those barriers are and are, you know, free to fully express themselves in that way. And that's really what my work is about, is I just want the amazing neurodiverse people in the world, because we need their brains. Their thinking is so amazing.
Yeah. Like,
they're the architects, they're the designers, they're the movie makers, the engineers. And we need that empowered, not held back because they didn't pass some SAT test when they were 10, do you know? We want them empowered and out there making, because we cannot solve them. Us word thinkers, and I think of myself more as a word thinker, us word thinkers are not going to solve the big problems on our planet with word thinking, because it's very linear, you know, cause and effect, da da da. No, we need to think like in a bigger, more complex and more sophisticated way to solve the big stuff, which is kind of a bit more my other things that I'm interested in. But I'm about empowering these young people and people of all ages. You know, my oldest client was 69 when I worked with her, and she had been a senior public servant in this country. Like, she'd worked, she'd been a mayor, she'd been a 3 times mayor, and she had hidden her dyslexia all her life, but she had failed kind of midpoint high school. And what she'd learned was how to speak well, and she spoke very well in public and was very intelligent and had a lot of nous, a lot of business and community nous. She was a great community builder and was one of the first women mayors in her particular area, and was at the forefront of a lot of women's rights movements, and amazing career. And here she was, she'd retired, and she wanted to be able to cook well for her family and follow recipes, and she couldn't do that. And so, I worked with her, and she was like, because it was always stressful for her, you know? And so we worked together, and she was able to produce great family meals, was because it was, you know, a new stage in her life. And she came out, she actually said, "I'm coming out as a dyslexic, just so everybody knows, so I don't have to hide it anymore." It's so
how stressful. Gosh. Yeah.
So she did it at this big party. It was amazing. She said, "I'm coming out." And they're going, "About what now?" Because she's out about lots of things. Yeah. And she said, "My dyslexia." And she shared. It was so inspiring. Someone of her, you know, age and reputation in our community, in our country, really, and to out herself and share what she got from her journey. And she said, "I don't have to feel bad anymore about how I was in school. Like, you know, I don't have to carry that anymore in my age now."
So. I bet it opened the doors for other people to speak up, right?
Yeah. And that's the thing, is as more and more people talk about it, and that's part of my work, I guess, talking more about the advocacy work, is the more that we can open up the world of neurodiversity as a positive, as an area or domain of giftedness rather than an area of disability, and address the things that tend to create the disability or the difficulties. I like to use the word difficulty rather than disability. Yeah. I know sometimes we need a diagnosis to get help, and I'm all for getting help for people, but I think the labels sometimes can put people in a box out of which they then have to box their way out of. It's difficult. Whereas if we can look at our neurodiversities as gifts that we can contribute and just remove the barriers, and those barriers are there for sure. I don't want to diminish them, but it's more about let's get to the root cause of it and be free of that and be able to do great things in the world, whatever that is, whether it's play soccer or basketball or cook from a recipe, be able to write your ideas. I've got adult students who, for the first time in their life, use the words they had in their head rather than the easy-to-spell words to write meaningful. Like, someone wrote a parole report for somebody. He works in a prison, and he was never able to write what he really wanted to say, and now he's able to. It's so moving, the difference in his writing from one line emails to, I get 1500 words from him.
Wow.
And they were always all there. That's the thing. Those words were always all there, but they were trapped inside his dyslexic confusions, and now they're free to make a difference to people.
Wow. That's incredible. Really,
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I see incredible. A 10-year-old, you know, struggling with spelling, or I keep thinking about that man and my, you know, 69-year-old client, and I think, what am I setting these young people up to be able to do and not have to go through those struggles in life, right? And be free as a young person to thrive. And in the end, the dyslexia is then a talent rather than holding you back.
Yeah, a gift. It's a gift, like you said. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yes.
So amazing.
That'll, Yeah, I love it. I just love my work. I love working with people, and I love working with the families, because the families start to see, oh, my kid is not dumb. My kid is smart, right? And they kind of have known that, but they haven't been able to really evidence it. And then sometimes they go, gosh, I had these difficulties myself, or my husband had these difficulties, or our grandmother had these difficulties. And so it's often for them a way of reconciling that past for themselves as well. Yeah, so that's really cool too. So it's that sort of network effect beyond the individual to families and ultimately, you know, schools and communities. As schools come on board with really helping people address these learning differences, then we just have a more thriving school community. And the other aspect of it is, because I also work with people with ADHD, which has got a similar mechanism but a kind of a different expression, often there's behaviour issues. You know, I'm very aware that bullying is one of the things that's increasing in schools, and behaviour issues, you know, kids acting out their frustrations. A lot of kids getting, in this country we call it standing down from their school, you know, like they have to go home for 2 or 3 days, and that pathway often ends up with them having to leave school, or being expelled, we say here. I'm not sure what you say in the US, but anyway, yeah. I'm starting to work with a lot of students who have those issues, and at the heart of it is their neurodiversity and the frustration with their learning. And then they act it out, right, as being disruptive or aggressive, or, you know, picking on somebody else, and that kind of behavior. And so, and sometimes it comes across as oppositional and defiant, and then those kids get labeled like that. And my prior background, before I worked in dyslexia, I worked in our prison service here for 8.5 years as an adult educator, working with our teachers and tutors and trade instructors to bring more literacy and numeracy into the training, because, again, those are often the barriers to the people succeeding at their studies or their vocational training. So I kind of I know the pathway from being a disruptive student in class to getting in trouble and getting a label as that. And then there's kind of a pathway that heads, they talk about this in prison literature, you know, from the schoolhouse to the jailhouse. And it's a horrible sort of thing to talk about, but it is a reality for many people. And so I also see the work I do now is ensuring that that doesn't happen to anyone that I work with, is that they don't escalate in those bad behaviours, they de-escalate those behaviours, and they're able to control the impulses and the frustrations and actually prevent them even arising, so that they become a better citizen in their school, a better participant in that school system. And they actually get to learn and less disruption in the classroom. So I have a young lad. He's a really, really bright kid. He came to me because of his dyslexia. I don't think he actually has dyslexia. I think he has more extreme ADHD. But he was very disruptive in the class. And last term, after we put in place some management strategies for the school, but also for him, self-regulating practices, he got acknowledged as having the most focused and productive term in school that he'd ever had, and he's 10. And his soccer coach acknowledged him for learning to control his anger and frustration, because he's a good player, but he'd get frustrated with other players. And so he got acknowledged at the end of year, you know, prize giving for learning to control his behaviour and his emotions whilst playing, which is cool, because I'm like, that kid is good now. He's sorted. He is not going to be an ongoing problem for himself or others. He's got the tools to manage that. And his learning's improving, surprisingly.
So do you have a way of, like, getting these stories out so other people know that this is possible? Because this is the first time I've ever heard. I thought, you have dyslexia, that's it. You can't read, whatever. And it's not like I had to deal with it, but these stories, I think, could really, I mean, here they are on the interview, but, you know, for parents who've never.
Yeah, this is how we get them out, really, is by having these interviews, having these conversations. I'm a very late comer to social media, but I finally over this kind of had a bit of a hiatus over this last few months, and I've been focusing more on sharing my stories, my journeys on Facebook and Instagram and so forth. But obviously, the more we can, and you know, other fellow facilitators around the world do the same thing, and we share the journeys of our students and things. And Davis International, which is the organisation I work with, are doing a lot of work now on expanding that conversation in the world. But I say that, you know, the Davis method is the best kept secret on the planet. We just need more people talking about it. Yeah. Because that's the thing. I would not want anyone to think, oh, I have dyslexia, or I have ADHD, or even myself or my family member has autism, that you can't do something about it. You absolutely can, with safe and effective methods that just work and play to people's strengths and learning styles. So definitely, if there was a message I wanted out there, you are not stuck with what you have. You can learn to work with it and thrive and have a great life. And that's
and not what I'm feel like. Yeah, and not, sorry, but and not what did you just say? I just talked over you. What did you just say?
Right. Yeah, just I would not want someone stuck with, oh, I have this neurodiversity and that's my sort of life sentence, right?
Yeah.
No, you can learn to work with it in a productive way, in a safe way, in an empowering way, so that you can fully express your talents and abilities in life, free of the constraints, if you like, of where the brain difference sort of intersects with our education system. Yeah.
And instead, I mean, it was a different thing, but my book is about not my third book. It's called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing, but it's about how to stop fixing yourself and start having fun, which is accepting like my negativity. I used to think was something I had to fix, but now I use it as a gift. It's my gift so that other people who are negative can feel like, oh, okay, I'm all right. So it's sort of the same thing. That was my thing. Theirs is that. And I can only imagine how terrible they feel that it's something's wrong with them, instead of, hey, I'm gifted, you know, with this creative talent. Yeah. So, all right.
Yeah.
All right. So let us go to our commercial break, and then we'll be back with all of your advocacy work, which is incredible. I mean, I feel like we've already got our money's worth here with the neurodiversity. Totally. I'm like, whoa, we got to let people know about this. All right. We'll be back, and then we'll get into the other stuff. All right. Thank you.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances,
enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Okay, welcome back to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And thanks again, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to bring, I don't know how it ties into the neurodiversity, but I'm sure it does somehow. If you want to bring experiential social emotional learning to your schools, businesses, teams, it's a way for people to get connected and just appreciate each other, which I think ties right into what we have been talking about. And then, as always, if you don't feel free to speak up, you don't feel free, you feel stuck, contact me at Hillary@gettingrealwithhillary.com and let's have a conversation. Because I was there and now I'm free, relatively free, and having a great time. So let's bring back our guest, Rachel. And here she is. Welcome back. Right. So we have a lot to cover in our 20 minutes left. But where do you want to start? I know. So that was Rachel.
That's Rachel and my day job.
Yeah, and her day job. And now she does amazing work in Africa. So
The connection then to Africa is through a fellow facilitator, a beautiful woman here in New Zealand called Claire Ashmore. And she had a connection through a program she's involved with called the Virtues Project to a man in Kakamega, Kenya. And Kakamega is right on the border of Uganda, near where the gorillas are up in the hills there. And it's a very remote rural part of Kenya. And he came along to a free webinar that Claire and I ran about 3 years ago for 90 minutes. And he borrowed a cell phone. This is how committed he is. He borrowed a cell phone from a student of his. He is a maths remedial tutor in Kakamega and works with kids who would typically drop out of school from elementary school age because they were not managing with their maths or their reading or whatever in class. And these classes are often really big, like 50 students plus, and, you know, teachers are pretty rare on the ground there. And so he's been running this center, and he came along to this webinar, and he took the tools that we taught in that free webinar and took them back to his students and had teenage students learn to read and write in their own language of Kiswahili as well as in English. And I'm like, I am interested in this guy. If you can do that out of a 90-minute free webinar, watching it on your cell phone, then I'm interested in working with this guy. So we've been putting together what we call the Kakamega Project. He's got 16 other tutors and parents who want to learn how to use these methods with their students that they're supporting. And we've had some Zooms and we've had some preliminary conversations, and we've been scoping how can we deliver a course that Claire and I are now certified to deliver, which is a dyslexia education. It's a 12-hour course. And we've been doing it live on Zoom. The challenge in Kenya is the connectivity and the power situation is not great. And so we're in the middle of now recording that whole course with the permission of the course creator, a man called Richard Whitehead in the UK. And he's very excited about the possibility that this work could be alive and making a difference in Kenya. And we invited Jeffrey to come on to our last live course in November. And each week he would post new videos and pictures of how he was applying the tools with his young students. And it's just really, really exciting. So we're at the stage of recording those 12 hours of training and setting up ways that we can interact with the tutors on a regular basis to support them through that training, so then they can take it out into their community and work with their students. And their family members. And it's very, very exciting I'm all about democratizing access to education everywhere, but particularly for people with neurodiversity, because in a country like Kenya, and Kenya's a pretty advanced country in Africa. It's one of the thriving economies there. But we estimate there's something like 10 million Kenyans who have some form of neurodiversity, and they are locked out of economic opportunities. If you don't complete elementary school, let alone high school, your options are pretty limited, what you can do in terms of earning a livelihood. And so our intention with this project is to start the ball rolling with, you know, building that economic base for individuals and their families and their communities, and ultimately, you know, wow, the Kenyan economy. So we've been fundraising with the support of the whole Dyslexic Society of Canada. And we're still fundraising because we want to get enough equipment and also teaching resources to those tutors and parents so that they can start working with their communities. Yeah. So
how did he find you originally, this guy?
Well, he came in through my colleague's network. So she's involved with a program called the Virtues Project.
Oh, okay.
And that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing group. And so he was a member in his community, and they did something, and so they connected that way. So that's the beauty of our internet world, isn't it, is how we can connect with people. And that's the cool thing. I mean, I always said after leaving Tanzania as a child, I would come back one day to contribute. And now with the internet, we can contribute without having to go necessarily. I mean, I would love to go back one time, but I think it's really what's the contribution we can make from wherever we are on the planet is what makes the biggest difference.
Mm. Wow. Now, and just one last question about this. Was that the Davis method that he was filming?
Yes.
And is that okay with them? Like, did you have to get special permission, or are they like?
No, he was just taking little snips on his cell phone, so just to show us what was happening in the classroom using the Davis tools. And
it's cool to bring it there. Yeah. Wow. That's
Yeah. There's a lot of support for this work being more widely available in Africa, and the challenges are mainly around just the connectivity, and so finding creative ways to do that and creative ways of resources and things. You know, we use a lovely plastilina clay that's quite hard to come by. So we've got people making other forms of Play-Doh, for example. And then a colleague in Nigeria just sent me through photos. She's working with a student, and they've got clay in their backyard. So they're just making a ball of clay and modelling the letters in their natural clay, and it works. You know, it helps that young learner visualize the letters accurately, and it'll improve her reading. So it is about being inventive with what resources that you have to hand, which is what, you know, the creator of the Davis method, Ron Davis, did, you know, as a child, is he just used the clay in his Californian backyard to make everything he wanted. Yeah.
That's so cool. Yeah.
It is very cool. So that's the dyslexia advocacy work and teaching work that we're doing in Kenya. And then I think the other thing you were keen to hear about is the leadership work as well. And so I attended a conference in 2020 online called the Conference for Global Transformation. And there were a couple of women there who had a digital poster called 1 Million African Women. And it had this beautiful African picture with it. And I was like riveted. And I went, I need to meet these ladies. And a friend of mine connected us. And we started this exploration of, given everything that had happened in 2020 with the pandemic and everything getting locked down, how could we empower such an initiative given no one can move, right? So we started doing Zooms and figuring out how to do Zooms. And we started a conversation in a country called Zambia, with which is in the sort of central southern part of Africa, if people don't have their African map to hand, but it's kind of in the middle. It's a little bit west of Tanzania, where I lived as a child, and it's north of South Africa and Zimbabwe. And we started it there because the founder of the organization that we've ended up working with, Daniel Kamanga, is he's based in South Africa, but he created the African Leadership Transformation Foundation, which we call ALT Foundation for short. And he is a graduate of a number of transformational programs, and he created a vision called 1 Million African Leaders. Wow. And he was busy organizing courses in universities around Africa, around transformation. And then, of course, the pandemic hit, and it was like, well, what do we do now? So we all convened around working with a team in Zambia who were graduates of some of these earlier transformational courses. And we started this inquiry, like, what does Zambia really need right now? And what we identified out of, and we created a summit, and we brought together leaders in areas of the climate crisis, areas of food production, women's advocacy, youth, because Zambia has a very, very young population. Something like 70% of their population is under the age of 30. So it's a very youthful population, and that has its pluses and minuses. The pluses is that, you know, they've got lots of vibrant energy and ambition. The downside is there are not many jobs. And so how do you help them develop livelihoods so that their lives can work?
Why is that, that there's not that many older people? Because they don't survive?
Well, no, there's just been a growth in the population.
Oh, okay.
There's partly that, like the life expectancy is probably perhaps lower than we would expect in other countries, but it's also, there's just a burgeoning young population. So Africa is the youngest continent in the world. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm and everything, but not necessarily the opportunities or the resources to make the best use of all that energy and provide people real livelihood opportunities. I'm not just talking about creating jobs, but like ways in which you can earn an income for yourself through your own enterprise. So these were the common threads that came out of that summer in 2020. And then we turned our attention to a couple of areas. And the first area is in Zambia, we created a project called the Inuvuntu Initiative. And Inuvuntu is a combination of the word innovation and Ubuntu, which is an African term for I am because you are. So it's about the whole idea of working collaboratively, collegially, for the greater benefit of the community rather than just for your own ends and means. Wow. And that's the ethic that we've brought to our project team. And our project team spans from Seattle all the way to South Africa and includes New Zealand and Australia in there at times. And so it's a really diverse. And now we have someone who's involved from Bangladesh as well. And so what we're doing right now is we've been workshopping, I guess, for several years, what kind of initiative would make the biggest difference, given a lot of the development projects are technically based and they come in with quite a bit of money, but not necessarily don't always leave behind expertise on the ground amongst the local population. And so our focus has always been, this has to be a local initiative, and it needs to bring in leadership development of people. It needs to privilege, if you like, women and youth, because they are the most vulnerable populations in Zambia and in countries nearby as well. Zambia, if you like, is a little bit of a test case for if we can do it in Zambia, there's opportunities to go to other regional countries. So really our intention with Inuvuntu is we're now focused on a particular sector in the agricultural area, because food security is a massive challenge in Zambia. So there's massive undernourishment. Food security is kind of the modern term for people being pretty hungry. There's undernourishment, there's stunting, childhood stunting in children because of malnutrition. And that's a big concern for a young and developing country. And a country that has the capacity to grow a lot more food, but what we want to focus on is growing, helping them learn to grow or relearn in many ways to grow more nutrient-dense food so that they're getting better nutrition from the get-go. So one of the sectors that's starting to grow grow in Zambia is aquaculture. So farming fish in ponds and lakes and rivers as an additional food supplement to their standard diet, which is typically products from maize, right? Which, you know, it's a starch, but it doesn't give a lot of nutrients, whereas the fish would supplement. And there's huge employment opportunities with fish farming, fish processing, you know, all of that. And so we're focusing our project around that and working with a group of women entrepreneurs. Now, these are farmers. They're called outgrowers. They're smallholder farmers. And they're very nascent entrepreneurs, if you like, you know, and they've got challenges with accessing resources, accessing support in their community for what they're doing. And so we want to bring in a whole lot of transformational leadership training to empower them, but also a whole layer of what we call adaptive systems thinking. So thinking about not just yourself, but how are you connected to other growers, or how are you connected to other suppliers? How are you connected to your markets and building those networks more powerfully? How as a group could you go and advocate for better financing, for example, for your businesses, or better policies, government policies, to enable you to do certain things that right now are not possible? So it's really a holistic approach that we're proposing. And then how would we attract financing as women develop those capacities and bring the youth in their communities into those businesses? How do we attract financing, on like impact financing, which is a longer term perspective? So investors would be looking for like patient capital, right? We talk a lot about patient capital these days, having it in for the long term to help these businesses get off the ground and flourish.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're almost out of time. We just have about 4 minutes left, believe it or not. We might have to have you back to finish up the rest of the initiatives, but just for the two that you were talking about, the Kakamega project and the InnoVent, why don't you talk about for a couple minutes how people can reach out, and we will put the links in the chat. And then I want to have enough time to have you, you know, talk about your vision and all that. So, and I have InnoVentu.org. InnoVentu.org. But why don't you say what you're looking for in a couple of sentences or less, so we have time to wrap it up.
Okay. Yeah. So with the InnoVentu project, we are at the moment looking for funding support, and we're putting together a funding proposal and going to funders. But if people are interested in some way in being involved or contributing in some way, they could reach us at InnoVentu.org. As you said, InnoVentu.org. All of our information is on there. And if people are interested in supporting the Kakamega project, if you Google the Kakamega project or look for it on the Raisley platform, that's our fundraising platform, you'll find it there. And yeah, we'd appreciate any support. And that really the difference with the Kakamega project is little goes a very long way to having a child have, you know, a really great life and be self-sufficient, really, which is awesome.
Yeah. And really, and we'll have the spelling and everything in the notes. So don't worry about it. What, for you, Rachel, what is your vision for the world, let's say 5 years from now or later, you know, that this is what calls you to help out all these people?
So my vision really is that people have access to the freely have access to the education that they need to have a life where they thrive, their family thrives, their community thrives. And that doesn't have to be dyslexia education per se, but access to what they need to live a thriving life, and so that we can have a thriving planet, because I believe that's entirely possible. And a lot of it comes down to people's education and being able to access and advocate for the resources they need to do amazing and remarkable things in the world that will help our environment, will help people's well-being, and help us all thrive, because I think that's our inherent gift and opportunity on this planet, is to be thriving. And so whatever makes that possible, I'm all for.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for, you know, for the work you're doing, for educating us, especially about neurodiversity. I had no idea, and I'm happy to spread the word about that. And also, you know, for what you're doing in Africa, and that, you know, your roots are now, whatever you want to say, blossoming, you know, that you had as a child. Yeah. So thank you. Yes. Just really thank you. Anything in closing?
Well, just I think for viewers out there, it's easy for us to think we can't make a big difference in the world, you know, and we can. And it may be from the comfort of your couch or your back room or whatever, wherever you are in the world, but you can make a big difference. And there's a world looking for people who are of genuine intent and genuine heart to be out there contributing. And, you know, these last 5 years have been challenging for a lot of people, but these opportunities have given me a renewed faith in humanity, a renewed heart for contributing to people that I may or may not ever see, but I see them every day or every week, you know, through this medium, and see the difference that's happening in their lives. Yeah.
Thank you. You mean see them in person? Is that what you mean?
No, I may never see. I probably won't see most of the people that I'm connected to right now in person.
Right.
You know, but it'd have been a very long tour through Africa if it was. but that doesn't matter, because we're connected with our intentions and our purpose and making a difference to people, and that's what really brings joy. And yeah. And so that's the thing. Like, people go, I wish I could do. Well, you can, is what I'm saying to people. You can step out of whatever you're doing and contribute. And it's the most rewarding thing. Mm.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Rachel. You're my hero, and I just really appreciate it. And I'm so happy that you've educated us so we can all spread the word. So thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Hillary, for the opportunity to share with your audience.
You're welcome.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started Getting Real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony, and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.